loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we discuss the developing political crisis in the U.K., as several members of Prime Minister Theresa May's cabinet resigned in protest of the draft Brexit agreement. Will May's government fall? Will there be new elections? Can we envision the possibility of a UK government led by Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn? And then we continue our weekly series every Thursday called Criminal Injustice, where we take a look at the most egregious conduct of the courts, the prosecutors, the police, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the Saudi-led coalition has ordered a halt in its offensive against the Yemeni port city of Hodeidah in advance of UN-sponsored ceasefire talks, apparently in response to Western pressure to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe. Millions of Yemenis rely on the port for food, water, and medicine and are in grave danger of starvation. Next, the ceasefire in Gaza appears to be holding, even as it may force the Israeli government to collapse. Yesterday's resignation of Israeli Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman and his party's withdrawal from the ruling coalition may be enough to force new elections. Still, Prime Minister Netanyahu, who also has appointed himself defense minister, foreign minister, and communications minister, will likely win with an even stronger coalition. Then, the global economy has hit a soft patch, putting the U.S. economy's robust growth at risk if the slowdown persists, according to the Wall Street Journal. Economic output in Germany and Japan slowed in the third quarter, while consumer spending in China hit a five-month low. And then a new study from Brown University's Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs says that by the end of the 2019 fiscal year, the U.S. will have spent nearly $6 trillion on the so-called war on terror. This differs wildly from the Pentagon's $1.5 trillion calculation because the Brown study also takes into account veteran care, interest on debt from the wars, and war-related spending from the State Department. And finally, new revelations have exposed a key force behind the unrest that rocked Nicaragua this year, leading to hundreds of deaths. That's the leadership of the Catholic Church. A recently leaked clandestine recording of Bishop Silvio Baez shows the high-ranking church leader directly coordinating the deadly barricades that were set up across the country. And in other headlines, Syrian news agency Sana is reporting that 17 civilians were killed in an airstrike carried out by the U.S.-led coalition in the northeastern province of Deir ez-Zor. The U.S. bombing campaign began in 2014, targeting ISIS forces, but has also led to many civilian casualties. The United States imposed sanctions today on 17 Saudi citizens for their role in the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Those targeted for sanctions include the 15-member team that murdered Khashoggi in Turkey, an official at the Saudi consulate where the killing took place, and Saudi Arabia's deputy intelligence director, Ahmed Al-Asiri. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee announced a new leader today. That's Nevada Senator Catherine Cortez Masto. The DSCC faces a difficult map in 2020, with few competitive seats up for re-election. Masto was elected in 2016. High-profile attorney Michael Avenatti was arrested yesterday and charged with felony domestic abuse. He was released last night and gave a press conference where he asserted his innocence. Avenatti was widely expected to run for president in the Democratic primary in 2020. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the developing political crisis in the UK, in Britain. UK Prime Minister Theresa May's hopes of selling a draft Brexit agreement to Parliament were dealt a serious blow today when several senior members of her cabinet, including the Brexit minister, resigned in protest of the deal. The resignations have May's government teetering on collapse, with many arguing that the Labour Party's Jeremy Corbyn is poised to become Britain's next prime minister. We're joined from London by Alexander Makouris. Alexander is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you.
Alexander, you know, when we've been covering this story, which we John and I have been doing on Loud and Clear pretty routinely. Whenever it seems like there's a modicum of stability, it's immediately upset with this wave of instability. Talk about what's happened inside Theresa May's own party and why.
I think you have to look back to this argument that went back, if you remember, to 2016 about whether Britain wanted to opt for a soft Brexit, that is a Brexit in which they maintained close economic relations with the EU, or hard Brexit. That was a Brexit where Britain basically severed all connections with the EU. Now, the problem was that Theresa May never made up her own mind about that, which of the two she wanted. So I think that in order to basically conceal that fact from everybody and from herself, she carried out an extremely secret negotiation, sidelining her own ministers, dealing directly with the European Commission through her civil servants, and ended up, as a result, with a deal that nobody wanted. And it is a deal that nobody likes, neither the people who support Britain's membership of the EU continuing, or with those who wanted to see a clean break from the EU. And now that that's all come out into the open, now that she's no longer able to keep it secret anymore, but has presented people with a deal that nobody likes, we see the whole situation unraveling fast. It's not just a case of ministers resigning from the government, though that is extremely serious. It looks as if there are now concerted moves within the Conservative Party to challenge Theresa May's leadership. If Theresa May faces that kind of challenge, all the talk is that she would now lose it. There is no obvious person to take over from her. That could spell an even greater political crisis, in which case the possibility of Jeremy Corbyn stepping in and becoming the next prime minister becomes very real.
Alexander, I'm looking at a piece in CNBC this morning that says, we don't really know what this deal says, that we think that it covers issues like a hard border in Ireland. It covers issues like the terms of the divorce, but nothing beyond. So people are up in arms. Ministers are resigning without really knowing what's in this 500-page document.
And doesn't that suggest, Alexander or John, that maybe they're resigning not because of the terms of the deal,
right,
but they just smell blood in the water?
That's it right there. You know, Alexander, I want you to comment on this. I think Brian's right. I think that we have ministers right now who see that the end is near and they're jumping in order to save themselves and save their futures in a new Conservative Party.
I think there is some truth to this in the sense that politicians are the same everywhere, and especially Conservative politicians are very much people who are focused on getting the best of themselves in a very fluid and dynamic situation, and they do smell blood where Theresa May is concerned. But if I may say so, I think that is perhaps a slightly overcomplicated reading of the situation. We do basically have a fairly clear idea of what this deal means in practice. It appears that it means that there's going to be some kind of transition period until 2021, during which Theresa May, assuming she remains prime minister for that long, is going to negotiate some long-term deal with the EU. If that doesn't happen, then Britain remains locked into a customs union with the EU indefinitely, which it cannot leave without the agreement of the EU or that of the Republic of Ireland. And the intention behind that is to preserve this so-called frictionless border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Now, that is an unacceptable position for many people in the Conservative Party, and it's an unacceptable position for many people in Britain generally. So I think, yes, there is a sense of blood in the water where Theresa May is concerned, but I don't think one should underestimate the anger that there is about this deal as it's been presented now. The fact that there's been uncertainty about it is a reflection of the secrecy with which it has been negotiated, which I discussed at the start of our program.
Alexander Mercuris, editor-in-chief of The Deran, is our guest. We're talking about the unraveling or apparent unraveling of Theresa May's government in the UK as a number of senior ministers from her conservative Tory cabinet resign in protest over the Brexit agreement. Alexander, as I understand it, and I haven't read the agreement, I don't see the other documents, but as I understand it, the UK would stay within the EU customs union, meaning that there wouldn't be tariffs and there would be a free flow of goods without having to be stopped and inspected.
Correct.
And weighted and, you know, all of the other procedures that can slow down international commerce between the UK, between the United Kingdom, between Britain and the other EU countries, staying inside the customs union. And at the same time, the other part of the agreement, or another principal part of the agreement, is the free movement of people would end. Up until now, if you were in, if you were part of the an EU country, let's say you were in Poland or Hungary or wherever, you could move and assume basically, well, not citizenship rights, but full rights as short of citizenship within the UK. And likewise, UK citizens could go to, I don't know, warmer climates and do the same. There's a grandfathering, it seems to me, or a grandfathering that those who are already in the UK from other EU countries could stay. The UK citizens who are in other EU countries, they could stay put. But this free movement of people would end. There would not be the basic right. So customs union, yes. Free movement of people, no. And then at the Irish border between the six provinces that are still part of the British Empire, Northern Ireland, that there would be a soft rather than a hard border. So in essence, the Northern Ireland would, unlike the rest of the UK, almost have the benefits or privileges of EU membership. Is that about it?
Yes, it is about it. But can I just explain a few points about that? Firstly, all members, all citizens, all people who live within the European Union are technically citizens of the European Union. That will end on 29th of March 2019, where British citizens are concerned. And you're absolutely right. Free movement will end. And this has been Theresa May's obsession. She has convinced herself that this is what most people in Britain are concerned about. She has pursued a relentlessly anti-free movement position involving migrants, involving students. Students who come to study in British universities are treated as migrants here, and the result is that they're actually included and restricted in how many of them are allowed to come in ways that were completely unprecedented in Britain before. So her focus has been on this, but it has not been on the other issue, which is, of course, the economic one. And what she always insisted on was that Britain would not remain a member of the customs union because the regulations of the customs union, the businesses, the directives that govern weights, measures, all the standards, all the rest, are decided by the European Union and are regulated by the European Court of Justice. Now, she specifically and repeatedly promised that Britain would not remain a part of the customs union, and in fact, she has now reneged on that promise. That is quite clear. As for Northern Ireland, the point about Northern Ireland is that she also committed herself, and this was in total contradiction to her commitment to leave the customs union, that there would be a frictionless border, in other words, a soft border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. And she has never been able to find a way round a position where she can reconcile the commitment she made to the EU and to the Southern Irish, the Irish Republic, for a frictionless border between the two parts of Ireland and her commitment to leave the customs union. So she has, in effect, ended up committing Britain to stay in the customs union. Now, that might be a credible position, but what I think has upset a lot of people in Britain most is that she says the agreement that we now have says that Britain cannot leave the customs union without the agreement of the EU. So Britain, in effect, has supposedly left the EU, but is putting itself in a weaker position with the EU where the customs union was concerned than the one it was in before.
Alexander Makouris is our guest. He is the editor-in-chief of the Duran. We're talking about the disassembling of the British government. We don't know if there will be early elections now, whether Jeremy Corbyn, very left-wing progressive leader of the Labour Party, could conceivably, almost impossible to imagine a couple years ago, become prime minister of the UK. Anyway, that's another big story. Again, he has massive opposition from within the Blairite wing, the traditional elite wing of the Labour Party itself. Alexander, I'm looking at a tweet by the author J.K. Rowling, Harry Potter fame. Hashtag Brexit has collided with reality, and now the cowardly bastards who plotted its course scramble for the lifeboat, squealing, quote, it's all her fault. We could have magicked the iceberg away, close quote. This is a crisis. The country has a right to speak again. We need a hashtag people's vote. I think she's suggesting referendum too.
Well, I think she is. I mean, J.K. Rowling is, of course, a very strong supporter of Britain remaining in the EU. And essentially, what we have seen as Theresa May has botched the negotiation is an awful lot of people saying, I should say, without, you know, they're making a very valid point. If we're going to remain indefinitely in a customs union regulated by the EU, with the British economy essentially regulated by the EU, then what was the point of leaving? Because ultimately, the British have less control over the regulations which determine their economy by leaving the EU, but staying within the customs union, than they did when they were members of the EU.
That's true.
And could control their regulations.
That's objectively true, because the UK loses any voice within the EU, which determines the customs union regulations in terms of trade.
That's exactly right. So, I mean, you know, one can see exactly the point J.K. Rowling is making. Now, Jeremy Corbyn's position, it must be said, is a rather different one, because, of course, he wants to carry out a root and branch reform of British society and of the way the British economy functions. And I think he feels, and he speaks for a strong tradition within the Labour Party, not one very represented by the parliamentary Labour Party, which says that this is not possible within the EU because the EU is very much organised around a neoliberal economic model, which is very much biased towards free market solutions, and that if Britain remains within the EU, then it would be very, very difficult for him to do some of the things that he wants to do without colliding into opposition from the EU and from the European Court of Justice. So he has a somewhat different position from other people within the Labour Party. But if I may say so, the point about Jeremy Corbyn, and you're absolutely right to say it would have been unthinkable a few years ago to think of a person like Jeremy Corbyn becoming prime minister. At least he offers clarity, and at least he also offers what, dare I say it, is a sense of direction and a degree of involvement of other people in what he is doing. Whatever your view about Brexit and how it has turned out, it is a far better, or at least to me, a far more attractive way forward than this extraordinary situation you have with a Conservative Party which is now feuding within itself, partly for the reason that you said, people scenting blood and manoeuvring for position because each of them wants to become prime minister, and also carrying out negotiations in this extraordinary way, which they haven't thought through and haven't any real plan for.
Alexander, I have to ask you, the British press today is pretty much unanimous that all Jeremy Corbyn has to do is hold the Labour Party together and wait for the Tories to fall apart. I think he probably can hold the Labour Party together, at least in the near term. What are the chances then of the Tories falling apart and being forced to call a national election that would allow Jeremy Corbyn to win and to form a government?
I'm not as sanguine about this as some of the people in the media are. And I have to say, I want you to be careful about this, because the British media is very opposed to Jeremy Corbyn.
Right.
And one of the reasons I suspect some of them are saying that is because they want the Tories to hold together. They want the Conservatives to hold together.
And they're trying to frighten people.
Exactly, to frighten people, so as to prevent the possibility of a Corbyn government arising. Now, in my opinion, he has played a very, very shrewd game, because he also has to consider the fact that though the majority of people who vote Labour are pro-EU, J.K. Rowling being, for example, an example of somebody who votes Labour but supports the EU, an awful lot of Labour people don't, and are opposed to the EU and voted against staying in the EU in the 2016 referendum. So he also has to manoeuvre to keep his coalition within the Labour Party together. So what he is doing is that he is being ambiguous about what he said. He's giving sort of indications that he might do one thing or he might do another thing, but he's not really committing himself too openly to a public position, whilst at the same time attacking the Conservative government very effectively. And I have to say, today, I think most people would agree that he stood up in the House of Commons and made a very strong impression. I mean, he was both today and yesterday. I mean, he's been an effective opposition leader in this situation.
Well, interestingly, he didn't say much over the past several days. And then, according to The Guardian this morning, he's been taking roundhouse punches at Theresa May all day.
It's what is called masterly inactivity up to now. And now, of course, he's moving into strike. Now, as I said, I have no doubt that deep down, he is probably somebody who would not, let's put it like this, he would not be averse to a complete Brexit, because, as I said, that opens the way for him to carry out the very substantial reforms that he wants to do. And but at the moment in time, as I said, saying as little as possible, keeping his options open, keeping the focus on the Conservatives, allowing the crisis in the Conservative Party to play out, exposing to the ordinary British public the extent to which, as I said, these people, as you said, these people are predators, political predators, smelling blood, circling around the wounded May. It makes a terrible picture. It is in his interests to keep the focus on the Conservatives as he keeps his own party together and manoeuvres more closely towards an election, which he hopes and expects to win.
Alexander Mercouris is our guest. I'm looking again at NBC News here in the United States. I want to go back to the Irish issue a little bit, because I think it's not understood.
To me, this is one of the most important issues in this entire Brexit deal.
It certainly is. And people don't understand. I mean, Ireland was a British colony as a consequence of the Irish revolutionary upsurge after World War I. The Republic of Ireland was formed. The six counties in the north, the so-called Protestant counties, of course, they're Protestant and Catholic, remain part of the UK. They still are. Theresa May had a snap election, thinking that she was going to stick a dagger straight into the heart of the Labour Party led by leftist Jeremy Corbyn, but it backfired, and the Tories went from being a majority party to a minority party, and they could only exist with the votes in Parliament, the 10 votes in Parliament held by Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party. These are colonialist, reactionary dinosaurs in Northern Ireland. She's dependent on their vote. Now, here's from NBC. Getting any deal through Parliament was always going to be difficult for May, who needs the votes of about 320 of the 650 lawmakers to support the agreement. The Conservatives are a minority government that is propped up by members of the Northern Ireland Democratic Unionist Party, DUP. But the DUP will not back any deal that treats the British province, that's Northern Ireland, differently from the rest of the United Kingdom. And the main opposition Labour Party said Thursday it would also vote against the plan. So help our audience, Alexander Mercouris, understand who is the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP?
Right. Let's start by addressing some of the fictions. One of the leading fictions is that Northern Ireland is supposedly a province of the United Kingdom. Northern Ireland has always been administered differently from the rest of the United Kingdom. There are no the major political parties, the Labour Party, the Liberal Party, the Conservative Party, are not present there. And, of course, at the moment, it has a separate administration, and for much of the time, it has been ruled directly by what was in effect a governor appointed by Westminster. So to talk of Northern Ireland as being a constituent part of the United Kingdom has always been a fiction. What you have had in Ireland ever since the Irish independence revolution of 1922 is a sectarian policy pursued by the British government, building upon a policy that the British colonial government operated ever since the 16th century of playing off a Protestant minority within the island of Ireland against the Catholic majority. Now, that Protestant minority was, in effect, made a kind of majority within this territory that Britain, for various political reasons, wanted to retain control of. I mean, major industrial and armaments works, for example, used to be concentrated there. And it is this sectarian Protestant grouping in the north of Ireland that is which is currently being used to prop up Theresa May's administration. Now, of course, they don't want to see a separation of Northern Ireland from the rest of Britain, because if that happens, then their position rapidly evolves into one in which they are a minority within the Irish, within Ireland, within the whole of Ireland. And it is very difficult to see how, in that kind of situation, they can continue to maintain their influence and their position. And in fact, it seems to me that in that kind of situation, Irish unification becomes inevitable. So this is where this is what the problem with these people is, and why they are taking this extremely intransigent position that you say. And when you call them reactionaries in terms of their social positions, that is, of course, exactly what they are. I mean, if people think that evangelical Protestants in various places are reactionaries, those in Northern Ireland take that even further. I mean, we're talking about 17th century attitudes in many cases.
Alexander Mercouris, thank you so much for that. John, you know, I think it's extremely important for people to understand the contradictoriness of all of this, because you can't separate one piece of this puzzle from the other pieces. You have the Irish question, which is a major question, and it's not simply about the DUP or what happens to those six provinces, so-called the colonial outpost of the British Empire. It's whether there's peace or war in Ireland.
True.
And that's what's at stake there. And then at the same time, we have the customs union. Will Britain and the British working people be under the control of Brussels-based bureaucrats who have a neoliberal economic policy, or could they go the direction of Jeremy Corbyn, meaning significant social and economic reforms? These are some of the big issues at stake.
Can I quickly interject? Very quickly, Corbyn supports a United Ireland.
True. Indeed he does, because he has an anti-colonial position. That was Alexander Mercouris. Alexander is the editor-in-chief of the Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you. Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, as always, there's a lot to talk about. There was a very interesting report from the Marshall Project, one of my favorite criminal justice-oriented websites, and it's entitled, The Courts See a Crime, These Lawyers See a Whole Life. What's that about? Paul, can you start us off?
Yeah, basically, the Marshall Project does an overview or looks at the how the Bronx Defenders operates, and this is a public defender agency in the Bronx, New York City. And basically what got their attention is the fact that rather than just focusing on the crime or the criminal case that defendants are charged with, but rather the, kind of the whole life situation that brings these people into contact with the criminal justice system. And of course, I think it's worth noting, of course, that by definition, public defenders only representing the indigent or poor people that are too poor to afford a lawyer, to afford counsel. So in a lot of respects, it's almost an aspect of, poverty law or the criminalization of poverty. But what a number of those studies have found is that basically by defending poor people accused of crime in this manner, that they actually get better results. Fewer of their clients go to prison. If they do, they go for shorter periods of time. And I think that, in a lot of respects, I think this is kind of like a common sense thing, is that it's just a matter of, how much time and effort you put into a defense generally generates better results. But I think that one of the things that the study doesn't say, or that the report doesn't say, is kind of like the implicit fact that, so much of American policing is really about containing politically and socially poor people in this country, is that, the brunt of the police state falls almost exclusively on the poor, regardless of their race. And in some respects, this is kind of, an outward manifestation of that.
Yeah, I like the idea of what they're calling holistic defense, because it's very unusual. It's rare to really get to the root of the problems of so many people who are caught up in the criminal justice system, especially in a place like the Bronx, especially in a big city like New York.
Yeah. And the Bronx defenders, I mean, they have their own unique genesis. I mean, they're a contractor with the Bronx Public Defender's Office, but they started in 1997 by people who were strong advocates for criminal justice reform. Talk about that if we could.
Yeah, I think that basically, I think in the mid-90s, it was a time of the tough on crime era. The Rudy Giuliani was the mayor of New York and pushing his brand of mass incarceration, which included, quality of life offenses where people were being locked up for, relatively minor technical offenses rather than actual crimes or violent crimes type thing. So I think they kind of grew out of a response to that. And, I think that's just been kind of a different approach of, what a lot of, what a lot of public defenders have taken. But, I think at the end of the day, though, the thing about the public defenders agencies is I don't think it's so much that, what some public defense offices would say, that it's not that some are more innovative or less innovative than others. At the end of the day, though, they're government employees. So it literally comes down to how much of an indigent defense is the government willing to fund. And you never see a parity between, say, prosecutor's office and public defenders. And again, and even this comes at a price, because I think some of you may remember a couple years ago, two attorneys from the Bronx Defenders appeared in a music video that was critical of the police. And they actually appeared in the video in their role as lawyers, counseling potential clients. And when the police unions complained about the fact that Bronx Defender attorneys were appearing in a video as a community education effort, they threatened to cut off the Legal Aid Society's funding if the lawyers weren't fired. And of course, they promptly were. Like, literally, they were out of the job within a day. And so, I think it comes down to, as well, is, how much of a legal defense or an indigent defense is the government willing to fund? Because at the end of the day, and it's a good thing that the city of New York is willing to fund a holistic defense. But in so many jurisdictions around the country, it's not that public defenders can't do it or won't do it or don't want to do it. It's just that they're not being funded to do it. And I think that's what comes, at the end of the day, it comes down to how much you know, how much of an indigent defense is the government willing to fund? And all too often, the answer is not much.
Yeah. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I just wanted to add to what Paul was saying about how, you know, so it's in rural areas where you have the most problem. And just to point out that, you know, under the Sixth Amendment, as the Marshall Project notes, they are required to provide these public defenders. It doesn't mean that they have to adequately resource those public defenders. It doesn't mean that they have to do any more than just make them available to somebody who is poor. And I do think that I wanted to make sure we, before we moved on, at least mention the numbers here, that in this study that they were looking at, because apparently the RAND Corporation and the University of Pennsylvania Law School was involved in compiling some of these figures. And basically, over 10 years, defendants under this holistic model spent 1.1 million fewer days behind bars.
Wow.
It's incredible, isn't it?
It's about 4,500 people who otherwise would have gone to jail.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible.
That's one office. That's what one. That just shows what can happen.
And that's we're just talking about the Bronx.
That's what I mean. It's like
if this were a national program.
Yeah, if this was a national program, it wouldn't solve the problem of mass incarceration, but it would be significant reform.
Yeah, 4,500 people who otherwise would have gone to jail avoided it completely. I think that's just incredible.
Well, it's also been said that the greatest prison diversion program in America is wealth.
Oh, you got that right.
Good point.
And, you know, but it also kind of assumes that, you know, the prosecutors are by definition just big old incarceration machines, and they're just on autopilot and absent any type of anything, that all they do is lock people up, which I think that's kind of a sadder commentary on the American police state.
Yeah, so true. I actually want to skip ahead a little bit because there was news from yesterday, the 14th, saying that President Trump announced that he is going to support passage of the First Step Act. I've written about this. Paul, you write about it all the time. Kevin, you've written about this a couple of times. This is real reform. This is real sentencing reform. Barack Obama supported a variation of it several times, and several times it died in the Senate just because both Harry Reid, when he was majority leader, and Mitch McConnell, when he was a majority leader, refused to bring it to the floor of the Senate for a vote. But it has broad bipartisan support, and now the president says he's for it. Kevin, start us off with the First Step Act.
Yeah, so I think that what this really develops out of is this bipartisan consensus that's been forming among the right and progressive left, so to speak. The Koch brothers have been investing money in this kind of legislation. And we can talk about, you know, what their profit motive and interest might be. You know, very, very basically, I would say that there are alternatives to jailing people that they probably see people they're connected to being able to cash in on. I mean, there's a wide conversation now about the whole concept of e-carceration, digital incarceration, the possibility of maintaining a mass incarceration system of individuals without putting them actually in buildings or these sort of institutions that are structures that, you know, have in meat space, you can see where they begin and end. There's a way of like putting people into shackles and chains without actually having those on those people because you can follow them and trace their movements digitally. So it's possible and likely that the Koch brothers are looking to cash in and that other neoliberal people who support this legislation are looking to cash in. But to what you say, you know, there's a very real political push from the grassroots to do something. And our show that we do every week is evidence of that because people respond to it favorably. They want something done about mass incarceration. And there are very real issues with this piece of legislation, but the one positive thing you can say about it is it comes from this effort throughout the whole country to actually address the fact that millions of people are incarcerated, that we're the number one country per capita when it comes to jailing people.
Yeah, it's true. You know, interestingly enough, this bill is something that has been sponsored several times by Representative Hakeem Jeffries, who's a progressive New York Democrat, and Representative Doug Collins, who's a very conservative Georgia Republican. They said that this is not a perfect bill. This is something that they've told the press, and they mentioned it even to CNN. This is not a perfect bill. It's a flawed bill. Flawed in that it could go a lot farther. But Jeffrey says you can't just wave a magic wand and have sentencing reform. That's just not how it works. It's something to pass, to have signed into law, and then to build on. But the goal is to essentially to end mass incarceration. As Kevin rightly points out, you know, the United States has 5%, is it, of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. And that's just unacceptable. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was going to say, though, that what's interesting about, I think in a lot of respects, is when you look at the laws that have been passed to create mass incarceration, like, you know, you look at the 1994 Federal Crime Control Act, which massively expanded the death penalty, and more importantly, gave the states billions of dollars for prison construction if they lengthen sentences for prisoners and reduce their opportunities for release, you know, created federal three strikes laws, expanded mandatory minimums. If you look at all the stuff that's been done to build the mass incarceration machine in this country, and just remember, the 1990s, it took the United States over 200 years to incarcerate its first 1 million prisoners, and then it only took us 10 years to incarcerate our next 1 million prisoners and double that prison population from 1 to 2 million. And so when you think about the massive sweeping measures that passed, with overwhelming bipartisan support, it wasn't like there was, opposition. I mean, there's in especially at the state level, these laws passed with not even nominal or token opposition. They passed unanimously or with super majorities. You know, when you look at how the mass incarceration machine was built in this country in the last 25 years or so, and then you look at these tiny, tepid, lukewarm steps that are hotly debated, you know, they aren't even looking for the magic wand. They sure look for that magic wand to lock up 2.5 million people. But now when it comes time to undo it, they seem to be kind of at a loss. And I think it's also interesting to note is that a lot of people, normally the people that tout incremental change and the advocates of tiny baby steps of progressive reform who wouldn't have an expansive vision of change if it hit them over the head, you know, these are the people that are also opposing it.
Well, that's an interesting and important point. If I can interrupt you right now, this is a very important component of this whole thing. In the Senate, you've got Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, who's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. This guy, well, and this is according to the Marshall Project, has become a stubborn and vocal defender of sentencing reform. So this is a guy who wants to see fewer people in prison and wants to see real sentencing reform. It says Grassley is the chief sponsor of the sentencing reform bill in the Senate and says that the House bill is unacceptable because it's not liberal enough, if you can imagine such a thing. This is the conservative Republican Chuck Grassley saying this bill is not liberal enough. More than 100 former federal prosecutors are endorsing this bill. Conservative groups such as the American Conservative Union Foundation, the Heritage Foundation, call this bill a no-brainer, and they're saying that it has to be passed. FAM, the Families Against Mandatory Minimums, said that it's been so many years since any meaningful bill has been passed that this is the best possible first start. So everything sounds great, right? Well, look who's opposing it. Most of the opposition comes from the left. Cory Booker, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, Senator Kamala Harris from California, Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois, Representative John Lewis of Georgia, and Sheila Jackson Lee. They are leading the charge against this bill. 100 civil rights organizations are also opposing the bill, including the ACLU. Kevin, do you have any idea why that is? When it just seems like even a flawed bill is better than no bill, because once you get something passed, you can then build on it for the future.
But I think their issue is where it's starting, because the letter that was sent, several of these organizations like the NAACP, ACLU, the Brennan Center for Justice, is looking at this legislation and saying, this isn't going to address the problem. You're not targeting at the right part. You need to target where people enter the prison system.
Right.
You're looking at the end when they're trying to remove people that they can with the least amount of controversy, without trying to risk any political capital on passing reform. And so that's the issue. And I think that, you know, this is common, right, to Congress, that let's pass the legislation that will cause us the least amount of political risk.
Yeah.
But, you know, in doing that, you oftentimes calculate incorrectly, because that's what happened with the Affordable Care Act. It was wildly wrong. And so the same could be said here with First Step Act in the way that they might decide to tailor this. A couple more specific issues that is raised by these civil rights groups is that it would eliminate community supervision as a possible option for people when they're in pre-release custody. And that could have a huge effect on recidivism reduction. And then the other issue is that the work programs that are normally available, part of this legislation might restrict those work programs and have an effect on only lower risk individuals being able to pursue these work programs. And we've talked on the show when we were talking about the way other countries handle incarceration, how valuable it is for people who are going to be punished and imprisoned that they have some kind of work program that they can be a part in, that they have something they can buy into while they're in prison, that they're not just idle, that they have something that they can do so that they can learn a skill, perfect a skill, maybe have some kind of training, because when they get out, they're going to need to reintegrate into society. So they can't just leave having done nothing for the last 10, 5 years or whatever. They won't, they'll have difficulty joining any kind of a workforce.
Yeah. Paul, the Marshall Project says that a reform-only bill would give President Trump what he wants, to look tough to his base by not budging on sentences while also showing evangelicals that he believes in so-called second chances. What does that mean, a reform-only bill that doesn't budge on sentences?
Well, basically, I think that's part of the thing about keeping the lengthy sentences. And, you know, what's interesting is that, you know, we haven't had any real sentencing reform at the federal level that's reduced sentences for large numbers of people in literally decades. I mean, there's the effort under the Obama administration, which reduced the sentencing cocaine disparity from 100 to 1. The difference between crack and cocaine sentences to 18-1. So, so they reduced the disparity, but not, by 80% or whatever, but, they didn't eliminate it. So I think that just basically this comes down to just an effort to try to deprive the president of, any type of legislative victories or any type of legislative chance that appears to, have an element of criminal justice reform. I also think it's important that we should note that, kind of the poverty of reform here is that, critical things that have really decimated, I think, the struggle for prisoner rights in this country has been the Prison Litigation Reform Act. There's no word about doing anything about that, changing that or repealing it. There's no talk or change about doing anything about the 1994 federal crime bill, which, really massively expanded mass incarceration at the federal, and most importantly, at the state level, by giving all these financial incentives for states to lengthen sentences and keep more people locked up. It's also not doing anything about prisoners' conditions of confinement. We're also lessening the financial exploitation of prisoners. And what's interesting is that a lot of this stuff, I mean, we have a president who's fond of executive orders. And a lot of this stuff, especially as it relates to the Bureau of Prisons, the president could do simply by signing executive orders.
Yeah, with a stroke of a pen.
Exactly. I mean,
that's right.
The same pen that he uses with rather carefree abandon when it comes time to, to go after immigrants and to do other things. But he's very miserly about, using his executive powers when it comes down to doing things that, in fact, I'm not even sure he needs an executive order. One of the things that the Human Rights Defense Center has battled with the Bureau of Prisons for many, many years, and I think as a former federal prisoner, John, you'll appreciate this, is the 300-minute limit a month on how long federal prisoners can speak with their families. No other prison system or jail in the country has that type of limitation on the frequency with which prisoners can communicate with their families. And this has a huge impact on prisoners especially that have children, that have large families, that seek to maintain close contact with their families. And this is something that I don't even think we need an executive order. This is just something the president can just tell the director of the Bureau of Prisons, hey, rescind the policy, let prisoners talk to their families, more. They don't need a 300-minute limit per month. And these are things that, like I say, you don't even need an executive order. One of the other things that we've raised with both the Bureau of Prisons and the White House over the years has been how federal prisoners' good time is calculated.
Yes. Oh, boy, that's a big problem.
It's a huge problem. When you talk about reducing mass incarceration, Congress, when they originally enacted sentencing guidelines in 1987, mandated that prisoners would receive 54 days a year of good time off their sentence if they behave themselves. The Bureau of Prisons has interpreted this to mean that they actually get 47 days a year off their sentences. And the Supreme Court held, well, you know, it's subject to the agency's interpretation. The BOP would be right one way or they'd be right the other one, and they upheld it. But this is simply an interpretation of a congressional law that's been upheld through multiple administrations. But a number of advocates, ourselves included, have long pointed out that the plain intent of Congress was 54 days. And simply ordering the Bureau of Prisons to calculate federal prisoner sentences on 54 days a year of good time versus 47 days a year of good time would literally, you know, save taxpayers, you know, thousands of years of carceral time and make prisoners serve the sentences they were actually sentenced to. And again, this is nothing that requires a legislative fix. The president can simply do it. I don't even think he needs an executive order. I think he can just tell his Bureau of Prisons director, hey, change your policy and make it comport with the law as Congress intended and make it 54 days a year. So I guess one of the things I'm not really sure about is why we have a president that's paralyzed and afraid to use his executive power when he could make significant steps, real concrete steps that would improve the lives of people that are in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and it doesn't require waiting for the legislature.
Yeah. Kevin, I want to switch topics. There's a case that the ACLU reported on that is just so wrong. It just screams out for justice. I'm talking about this this ICE detention center in Pennsylvania. It's contending that it's not responsible for its staff members' sexual abuse of detainees. And the odd defense is that it's not responsible because it's not a jail or a prison. It's a detention center. What happened is that there's a young refugee, 19-year-old refugee with a 3-year-old daughter from Honduras. She was forced into sex with a guard, a prison guard, and he pleaded guilty to institutional sexual abuse, but not guilty to civil rights violations. And the other guards who stood around and laughed while he raped this woman are also contending that they're innocent because this is a detention center and not a prison or jail. Can you explain this?
I'd like to say that I think this amounts to something that maybe has received attention in the era of, you know, quote unquote, Me Too, which is that people don't recognize that rape comes down to power. It comes down to how people have dynamics or have relationships in certain settings. And so if you're saying that a prisoner and someone who works in a prison can have consent, then you don't have any grasp of reality, basically. I mean, I don't think you should take a person seriously that would suggest that, because very clearly, anyone who can put you in handcuffs, order you into a strip search, lock the doors, take the keys, walk away, deny you access to hygiene items, deny you the ability to visit, make phone calls with family. Anyone who has that to hold over you, you know, in this case, we're talking about immigrant detention, so probably it's even worse. You've fled some region, like, and specifically in this instance, we're talking about Honduras. So you fled some country that's been wrecked by United States neoliberal or imperial policies, where, you know, the government supported a coup in the country or has supported right-wing forces that have destabilized your country. So you've got a woman who has fled that, whatever violence was going on in there, and come to the United States, is detained there with her child. And the power dynamic there is that I'm not going to cross this person who holds power over me, because I know that I'm in survival mode at this moment. And, you know, if sexual violence is something I have to endure to survive, that might be a choice that I have to make.
Yeah. Paul, where does this poor woman go from here?
Well, hopefully she goes to court to seek redress for the injuries that she suffered. But, you know, someone who's been reporting on the sexual abuse of prisoners for decades, you know, a lot of this, especially, you know, the government response that they're not responsible. I mean, that's why you have the systemic and endemic sexual abuse of prisoners and detainees all over this country is, you know, we have a bureaucratic police state where no one's ever responsible. The buck never stops. And at the end of the day, I think it just comes down to the thing of, you know, we've got a situation here where it was the government that put her in a cage, the government that hired the people that oversaw her, the government that's responsible for maintaining standards and training people. And then when they call for criminal responsibility and civil liability for us common folk, for the citizens, but when it's the government that's the rapist, when it's the government that's the perpetrator, suddenly no one's responsible. You know, no one knows what to do. No one knows how it happened. And I think this is just part of, you know, this is just part of, I think, the paradoxes of the American police state is, you know, liability and criminal responsibility for everyone but the police state.
I think that's what it comes down to. We've got only 1 minute left. Kevin, how about you take us out? There are a bunch of issues that I think are so important today. We don't have enough time to talk about them. What do you think is the most important issue that we haven't covered?
So I just would say to a conversation that we're having, if there's just a political opportunity to do something about criminal justice reform, and you say it's a once in a lifetime opportunity to do something to address many of the issues that we talk about on this show, I want people to keep in mind that whatever we do, if Congress were to pass legislation, it would release the pressure. You know, the pressure valve would be turned. They would no longer have the pressure to address issues of systemic injustice, racial injustice, and then they would move on. It would be similar to like dealing with Florida and felon disenfranchisement. And so I think these issues with the bill and these sort of things that we talk about on the show need to be kept in mind when pressuring congressmen or advocating for change.
Indeed. That was the voice of Kevin Gastala, who joined us from Chicago. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.